Today on Against the Grain, dock workers the world over have a long tradition of both power and militancy, able to block the flow of cargo and jam up the workings of capitalism. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union in the San Francisco Bay Area has been one of the most radical unions in the U.S. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Peter Cole joins me to look at the fascinating history of the ILWU and how an originally white workforce committed itself to racial equality and integration, and how the later majority black workforce became the radical backbone of the anti-apartheid and the international solidarity movements in the Bay Area. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union, which represents dock workers along the west coast of the U.S. and Canada, was born out of intense class struggle in the late 1930s. Since that time, it has remained one of the most militant unions in the U.S., and its Bay Area members have been at the forefront of radical struggles from civil rights to anti-apartheid, shutting down the West Coast ports in protest of the Iraq War, among many other actions of international solidarity. Peter Cole has examined the Bay Area ILWU's radical tradition in his book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. He's professor of history at Western Illinois University and a research associate at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. Peter, let me start by asking you a very broad question, which is, why do dock workers matter so much under capitalism?
I think that's a great question. It's an important one, and it does take us back. I'm a historian of the 20th century mostly, but we could even go into the 15th century. The rise of capitalism and the rise of imperialism are codependent on shipping. Both happen simultaneous. One doesn't happen without the other, right? No ships, no conquest of the world from Western Europe, right? Simultaneous, you have the rise of the shipping industry, because why would you try to conquer other places, really, to sort of extract wealth, natural resources, sell finished products, etc. And so those who work aboard ships, sailors, and those who load and unload ships at ports, dock workers, are absolutely central to what I call the first industry of capitalism. And dock workers and sailors, but also other workers in the what we now call logistics, play these roles in moving cargo around. Yeah, but shipping, even in the 21st century, is something on the order of about 90% of the goods we consume move part of their journey or a lot of their journey by ship, not just by rail, truck, ship. And so over the last 500 years, dock workers have been vital to capitalism, but also in our times. Yeah. And then I guess the last point I might want to say is, because it's so interesting, I think, the origins of the word strike are maritime and are nautical. So to take down a sail of a ship is to strike a sail. In London, which was the greatest port in the world in the 1700s, and the 1800s. In London in 1768, sailors went on strike. That meant they withheld their labor and they took down their sails to push the employers. And as a result, the action that they did became sort of synonymous with workers stopping work, strike. And so that tells us also about the centrality of maritime to the economy period.
And as we will talk as we go through the hour, in some ways jumping ahead, obviously the importance of shipping and of dock workers intensifies as, in some ways, as capitalism does, although the forms change.
Yes, very much so. And although it's been in some ways similar for centuries, in the 1960s and 70s, really, and a major theme of my book is technological change, there's been orders of magnitude increase in trade in the last 50 years due to the containerization of the industry of transport, starting with shipping and then spreading to truck and rail. And so, yeah, as capitalism has grown and changed, so too has shipping somewhat. But really, in the last two generations, everything we think about in terms of made in China or production in some distant land is not exclusively, but could not have occurred without something like containerization, the process in which transportation moves goods, cargo, from A to B to C.
We're going to be talking about militant dock worker unions, but I wanted to ask you generally, would it be fair to say that dock workers have had a particular tradition of radicalism, or is that something that is more specific to particular times in particular places?
Well, I write about the San Francisco Bay Area, both sides of the bay, San Francisco and Oakland, but also Durban in South Africa. And although I think that those ports are particularly interesting and important, it's not unique at all. In fact, dock workers and sailors have long histories of militancy, as you say, for a variety of reasons. One, of course, is they work together. I am a professor. I work often by myself. But to load and unload a ship or to move a ship from port to port requires collective effort, right? And so the work itself creates a consciousness of collective effort. That doesn't mean you act collectively, but you start to think about each other. There's the fact that the industry is dangerous. Shared danger, shared suffering often binds people. We think about that in terms of the military, but it equally applies to coal miners, gold miners, as well as dock workers or sailors. There's a strong us versus them mentality. Like, there's no one rising up out of the ranks of the docks to become the owner of a ship. Right, or a corporation, right? And so this social mobility, there is a pretty clear ceiling and a very clear division between those who are trying to work you faster and harder because the ship must sail on time and because time is money in transportation. And so these sorts of forces result in militant dock workers in London, right, in Hamburg, in Sydney, as well as in San Francisco or Durban. So the industry, it's not unique to this industry, but there's a number of components to the industry that are no secret, right? I'm not the first scholar to note that, geez, these dock workers seem to time and again in many different parts of the world in many different times and under different sort of regimes have the potential power, but also have demonstrated a proclivity to organize collectively time and again.
And would it be fair to say that the fact that, because of all the reasons you've just described historically, that dock workers have been so important for the flow of goods under capitalism, that their awareness of their power, and presumably all workers have power, but some workers have more power to really choke up the system. Has that lent itself towards more radical aspirations?
Dock workers are very proud of their role in the economy. Most dock workers, like most humans, are not anti-capitalists, but like they're very mindful that what they do is very important. And although I hate to hate on people, if I make paperclips and I stop work, it doesn't stop the flow of the economy in the way that transportation workers do. So too, if I don't show up for work to teach my students, that also does not stop the world economy in the way that dock workers do, right? And so there's all sorts of white and blue-collar jobs as well as every other. And some workers do have inherently more power than others. But of course, if you organize well, you can sort of improve your conditions and I think your world. But transportation workers, you might call it supply chain, you might call it logistics, all those are right. They definitely, and that's, again, no secret to employers, but it's also no secret to those of us who are thinking about how to make things different. And there are a number of people, including a sort of a labor writer named Kim Moody, who writes extensively about transportation being a particular node. And so if we're thinking about not just the past, which I love to do, but also the future, which I also want to do, well, who do we want to organize? So if you have limited resources and time and effort, well, you should probably make sure that those transportation workers are organized before you organize the paperclip workers.
Well, let's turn to the particular dock workers that you focus on in your book, Dock Worker Power. Starting with those in the Bay Area who are organized in the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, what are the origins of that union?
So there had been efforts to unionize dock workers in many ports in the U.S., but also in many other countries in the 19th century and the 20th century. And there was already a union in the United States called the International Longshoremen's and Association, ILA, and they had been around since the late 1800s in most, if not all, the major ports in the country and many of the small ones, including in the San Francisco area. That union had been sort of defeated in a post-World War I strike in 1919. And then there was a company union that was emerged in the 20s. Company union basically means companies set up a sort of a shell organization that they claim represents worker interests, but really is a way to contain and weaken workers. Workers understood this, but nevertheless it existed. But in 1934, 5 years into the Great Depression, a time not only of suffering, but also of tremendous organizing in many places, not just the Bay Area, Minneapolis, New York, pick a place, where dock workers in San Francisco, which was for many, many decades already the largest and most important port and the largest, most important city in the West, not just the West Coast, but the entire Western U.S., went on strike, along with dock workers in every other port on the U.S. West Coast. So it was a coast-wide strike, affiliated with the ILA, New York City-based, but that big strike, as it's referred to in the sort of lore of the union, lasted for the better part of 3 months. For a while in July of 1934, on July 5th, right, several workers were killed by the San Francisco police, nicknamed Bloody Thursday. They weren't the only workers killed during that strike. There were 6 workers coastwide killed in the strike of 34. But out of that Bloody Thursday famously emerged the San Francisco General Strike, in which workers in dozens of industries and hundreds of thousands of workers were affected to shut down the city in solidarity with those who had been killed and in honor of them. And then after, and with a much more favorable government under President Roosevelt and the first ever female member of a U.S. presidential cabinet, Frances Perkins, Secretary of Labor, negotiations were reached and sort of finalized, and workers won huge concessions from employers in 1934. Coastwide contract, so in other words, similarity of wages and conditions coastwide, so you don't play workers in different ports off each other because ships could easily unload or load in different ports and then just move the goods inland. Raises, reductions in hours, recognition of a union, and more. And also out of that famously came a new leader named Harry Bridges, who was an immigrant from Australia, but who had lived in the Bay Area for over a decade. He was a left-wing leader. He may or may not have been a member of the Communist Party. There's ongoing debates about that. I don't really care. But there were many communists around, as well as many other leftists, Wobblies, Trotskyists, socialists of different stripes. And Bridges was very much a part of this left insurgency that was embraced by and led this strike, not just in the Bay Area, but Seattle down to L.A. Bridges became then the first president and served for 40 years as president of the ILWU, whose name was the International Longshore Men's and Warehouse Men's Union. But in the late 1990s, they degendered their name intentionally, even though the industry remains largely male. The ILA still has a gendered name, and that starts to tell us a little about why they broke away. The ILWU was a left-wing radical alternative to a more conservative, less democratic, more corrupt, and still existing New York City-based union that represents dock workers in the Gulf and the Atlantic coast.
So this union, formed out of these radical origins, was at its inception a predominantly white union. How did these people in the 1940s and the 1950s think about race? Because, of course, when we think of unions, we tend to think that people are acting for their own immediate self-interest or perhaps their more immediate collective interest. How did the sense that their collective interest involved racial equality, how did that emerge?
So that's key. It's really the first major theme in my book is how unions, and I'm a human, I'm selfish, right? Like, I'm an animal. So, like, I don't blame people for wanting to put their self-interest first. Humans do that, right? But unions generally try to do that to help a group of people, and that includes materially, right? Improved wages, safer conditions. And, well, that's better than non-unions. The unions that I've chosen to study and focus on in my book are not unique, but unusual, in that they use their power not only for help themselves, which I presume we all want, but also that we redistribute wealth downward. So we're taking some wealth from the corporations and at least giving it to more people, that they use their power to fight for racial equality. Multiple reasons. So pragmatism, we are stronger together. united more of us. We are stronger than if we're divided. Time and time again in the United States, workers have been played against each other by bosses. African Americans hating Irish Americans, hating Italians, hating Poles, hating Jews, hating women, etc. Right? Like, who wins in that scenario? The employers win. The result being lower wages, weaker workers. So that is logical. However, logic alone does not explain this, because that logic actually has failed to convince many workers in many places, including white American union workers, time and again. So what made this workforce different? Now, San Francisco before World War II was 1% African American. Oakland, 3%, right? It's only during World War II in the 40s that the black population increases. Even prior to the great migration of African Americans, largely into the East Bay, but also working in San Francisco and living there, this union, because of its left orientation, took a stand against racism. Now, that was pragmatic. For instance, employers might not be able to hire African Americans to come in and replace workers for cheaper. However, like I said, pragmatism doesn't explain it alone, because pragmatism has failed to convince most unions in that era to do what this union did. So because they were anti-capitalist, they also made a statement or concluded that they should be anti-racist. Workers are workers regardless of their ethnic, racial, or gender, Jewish, religious, national backgrounds. Yeah. And so many, not all of these dock workers were leftist or convinced of this. And not only the leaders, but also many in the rank and file, especially in Local 10, which is the San Francisco Bay Area local, and the largest and most important in the union for most of its history. They reached out to African Americans who worked in the waterfront to sort of make sure they'd be included. So they made a choice to be inclusive. They reached out to other black labor leaders, including a guy named C.L. Dellums, who was the uncle of Ron Dellums and was the leading black trade unionist in California, a national leader in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. But Oakland was essentially the end of the line for railroad porters, and that's one of the reasons that blacks lived in West Oakland. Dellums was an ally from the start, right? And then, as you said, during World War II, when the black population of the Bay Area skyrockets due to really shipbuilding, some end up on the waterfront, too, several thousand. And Local 10 immediately not only includes them, but treats them equally and fights for them when they are mistreated by white employers. By contrast, the shipbuilding unions, for instance, were exclusionary and or Jim Crow, i.e. segregated, and or denied blacks equal pay, equal work opportunities, etc. And so there were other unions in the Bay Area at that time who were handling African Americans in a drastically different manner than the ILWU was. And this was no secret. Blacks understood this quite well. And for instance, when Cleophas Williams, who became in the late 60s, the first African-American president of Local 10, arrived on the waterfront in 1944, near the end of the war, from Arkansas. He said, "When I arrived on the waterfront, I thought Local 10 was a utopia." It was literally the first time, he said, and I interviewed him multiple times for the book, the first time he had met white people who were not racist. Now, I don't know if they were racist or not. In the heart of hearts, who knows what people think. But in their actions, Cleophas was judging them as treating them like a fellow worker, regardless of the skin tone. And he and thousands of other African Americans quickly appreciated that, understood that this was not only sort of inclusive and egalitarian, but also that they would benefit materially from being in this union and working in this place.
I'm speaking with historian Peter Cole about his book, Dock Worker Power. This is Sasha Lilly, and the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what was the internal life of this union like? And to what degree were the radical ideas that many of the members had expressed in the union itself? And what happened when other unions felt the squeeze of McCarthyism? Was the ILWU a place that they could turn to?
So the first one, how did this union organize itself? Yeah. So again, because of its left orientation of its leaders and many of its members, they were sick of being played against each other. And dock workers hated the fact that when they would show up for work, and this industry is called casual labor because you don't have a weekly job, a monthly job, a yearly job. You get work by the ship or by the shift. And so that means you have to show up and be competing against your fellow workers all the time in what was nicknamed the shape-up. Now, the union ended the shape-up immediately. Instead, they had a hiring hall. And in San Francisco, it still exists, 400 North Point. It was built in the 50s, and it's now in a touristy area near Fisherman's Wharf. But it used to be an active maritime working area. So at Local 10, you'd show up. If you wanted to work that day. So you don't have to actually show up for work. If you don't feel like it, you want to go to the track, you want to go to the mountains, you actually can do that without asking anyone's permission, which is kind of amazing, and many of us would like that. But if you do show up for to be dispatched because you want to get paid, you don't get paid if you don't work, how does the union decide who goes to this job? Now, it used to be you had to show up at the piers and try to beg for a job. Now the companies call up the union, say, for instance, we want 100 workers tomorrow at Pier 34, to work coffee beans, because Hill Brothers was a big coffee company, and beans would come up from South America and be unloaded right near what's now the Ferry Building, and you see the Hill Brothers sign, and you're unloading coffee. Okay, who gets that job? Well, first of all, we elect our dispatchers. So one of our own who we trust, and every year we vote for new dispatchers so that if we don't like the dispatchers, we don't think they're fair, they're not going to get bribed the way the old bosses would get bribed. Secondly, we set it up so that whoever in that quarter of the year had the least amount of hours worked would get first opportunity. So the last shall be first. They called it low man out, right? And so they actively sought to equalize opportunity in a way that very few workplaces and industries do then or now, right? And so you could call this Christianity. I think that they were socialists. And this wasn't, again, unique to the Bay Area. This was in every port that ILWU controlled, that they would have union member dispatchers elected by the rank and file who would then dispatch people based on essentially who had the fewest amount of hours worked, i.e. had earned the least money. And they would get the jobs first. And again, that was regardless of race or any other ethnic or national. There are certain skills, and so they would have certain jobs would be available to some people and not others based on their skill sets, although most jobs were generally open to whoever wanted to sort of ask for that job, right? And so that's dispatchers. Now, as you said, during the, well, even before World War II, Harry Bridges and others, but especially Bridges, was targeted by the federal government for persecution because, well, he was a very strong, outspoken, powerful, left-wing, unapologetic labor leader, right? And even in the late 30s, that gave pause to many employers, but also conservative Southern white Democrats and conservative Republicans. And so HUAC was actually created before World War II, the House Un-American Activity Committee, although it really gained steam with the rise of the Soviet Union after World War II, as you noted. And Bridges, it's not really a major feature of my book, but Bridges was the leader and is a powerful, important figure, and is San Francisco-based. He spends 20-plus years of his life fighting against multiple court cases that the Department of Labor, Immigration and Natural Services, Department of Justice goes after him time and time again. Literally, his case is heard on two occasions by the U.S. Supreme Court. But in every case, he essentially effectively defends himself. He could be deported if he's proved a communist. He claimed he wasn't. And so he effectively convinced courts time and again that he wasn't a communist. It's a very complicated story and one that other people tell much better than me. But he was not alone. In fact, especially during the Korean War in the early 1950s, thousands of workers on ships and in ports on the U.S. West Coast, because the war is being serviced in Korea by the West Coast, found themselves persecuted for their political beliefs in this industry, which in fact is not only economically important, it's politically and militarily important as well. And not only was San Francisco the leading cargo port, it was also the leading military naval port. San Diego has a lot of ships, but actually a lot of troops are shipped out of the East Bay, and there is a lot of shipbuilding and naval operations throughout the Bay Area too, historically. Really not much anymore.
So the ILWU from that time to the present has been very much part of the history that people tend to think of as the larger history of social movements in a place like the Bay Area and beyond, the civil rights struggles, then the explosions of the 60s and 70s and beyond. And yet the ILWU is really embedded in a lot of those struggles in a way that I think is missing from quite a few of the histories of those periods, because they tend to see those struggles as being outside of the realm of the labor movement. Why do you think that the ILWU was so involved from civil rights onwards in the larger struggles of the left? Was it because of the particular culture of the union? But of course, every organization, even those with radical beginnings, turns over with time. New people come in, the world around them changes. Was it because of this institution itself? Was it because of its connections to social movements? Did it happen to be about different generations of people renewing those sort of radical ties? How do you understand it?
Well, those are great questions. In the 30s, yeah, dock workers are very much a part of the labor movement. And I think I agree with you very much that sometimes people divorce the labor movement from the social movements, where I consider essentially organized labor to be the single largest and most important social movement. Nevertheless, there's a lot of us, including many academics, who separate those.
Sure.
And I think that's incorrect. Now, in the Bay Area, as you said, and a lot of my book talks a lot about how dock workers collaborate with other community groups, religious groups, unions, civil rights groups, Chicano groups, American Indian groups, to sort of give support to these different causes. Partially it's because their membership is diverse, and so they're in these communities too. They're not divorced from. These are working class and middle class communities in both sides of the Bay. They fight. I think that in the 60s, as many new left and other social movements rise, AFL-CIO is seen as an enemy, right? AFL-CIO is so-called big labor, is often sort of grouped with big corporations. You know, unions, in fact, had resulted in many middle-class Americans, which I thought is a good thing. But, you know, a lot of those unions essentially did not give support to these other social movements, in particular Vietnam, where generally labor unions were supportive of the war in Vietnam, especially the international leaders in the AFL-CIO, George Meany. And so a lot of young activists saw the AFL-CIO as the enemy, right, because they supported the war. ILWU actually was anti-war and was not in AFL-CIO. Nevertheless, in the literature, when you read about the history of the 60s, including even the Bay Area, Local 10 and the ILWU are really left out, and I'd like to think that my book is a corrective. And really, far too many, there's not that much written about the ILWU, but it's overwhelmingly about their 1930s, the big strike, and bridges, right? And they're important, but really nothing's been written almost about the post-World War II era. But the things they do are fascinating. Now, why they do these, again, a lot of these people are radical. So it's not like they're having to collaborate with and find other radicals. They are among these other groups, right? In the Bay Area, the activism of the Bay Area, I think, comes out of this, right? I think a lot of people who think, oh, the Bay Area has this fascinating radical history, if they don't know Local 10's role, they actually don't know what they think they know. It is not the start place. The fact that it's a port city is a start place. That explains why the city is so diverse, so cosmopolitan, so international in ideas and people, right? And so it's the port, and then those who work in the ports. Every day they meet people from Chile, from Japan, from Germany, right? They bring that activism then into the communities, right? They're especially supportive of the civil rights movement, and that's a lot of my book. As you said earlier, 1% of dock workers are African American in the 30s. By the late 1960s, the majority of Local 10 is African American. They actively recruited African Americans as well as other workers of color. By when they had in the 60s, when they were starting to hire or bring in more people into the union as retirements were happening, they went to Hunter's Point and the Bayview. They went to West Oakland intentionally, because they not only wanted to recruit African-Americans, they wanted to recruit poor people, right? And help them uplift, right? And so over time, the union is reinfused by people who are committed to the union because they've benefited from the union in a lot of ways. There was also a reinforcement of the sort of left traditions because, as you noted earlier, due to McCarthyism, people who are red-baited out of other trades and unions found safe harbor, if you will, in the Bay Area's Local 10 and other elements of the ILWU, right? And so it wasn't just the founding generation, but then subsequent generations are also. And again, the work itself, as I mentioned earlier, in some ways creates collective identities and radicalism. And then going to the hall every day, where while you're talking to people, you're learning about the trade, you're learning about the tradition, you're learning, you're talking to folks, and on the job, because the job was very social in the sense that when you're working in a gang, in a pair, right, well, you're talking to people. Leo Robinson, one of the guys I interviewed for the book, he's like, I became a radical during the 60s because I was working in a hold with an old white communist named Archie Brown. Leo Robinson's African-American, born in Oakland. He's like, he started asking me about Vietnam and what I thought about it. And of course, that was a sort of an intentional opening that resulted in Leo over time coming to be very anti-war. Once you're educated about some issues, you often, your eyes are open to other related matters. And so Leo was already an active union supporter and believed in racial equality as a black guy. He became more radical, right? It continued in a variety of different ways so that Local 10 was involved in the anti-war movement, very involved in solidarity work with the farm workers, very involved in support of the American Indian occupation of Alcatraz, very supportive of the San Francisco State strike. This is the 50th anniversary of the strike. Some people in that strike leadership were actually the children of ILWU members. The tentacles all of these are dense and many, right, and make for a fascinating, I think, history. I could have written a book just on that stuff. That's actually just a few chapters of my book.
And the book in question is Dock Worker Power. We'll return with its author, Peter Cole, after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Peter Cole. He's professor of history at Western Illinois University and a research associate at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. We're talking about his book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find a link to that on againstthegrain.org. So as this radical history of the ILWU in the Bay Area, this radical dock worker union, continues, sort of renews itself over decades. At the same time, of course, capital doesn't sit still. The power of dock workers the world over is seen as a possible impediment to the expansion of capitalism. And of course, in the 1960s, you get the beginning of what often gets termed globalization, exports and imports becoming so central to the global economy through these multinational corporations. In the context of all of this, the shipping companies adopt technological changes that are very significant to do with containerization. Can you explain what containerization is and why it is so important in this larger story?
It's my pleasure. I didn't intend to write a book about the subject, but as I was talking to more people and studying more, I came to appreciate how important and interesting this is, how largely unknown it is, and how central, in fact, the San Francisco Bay Area and this union, Local 10 and the ILWU, was to this story, which is a global story, as you said. So traditionally, literally for millennia, the loading and unloading of ships was not so different, right? Lots of teams of men, pretty much, who, using brute strength but also some skill, would load ships. Every cargo is different, every ship is different, and so there's actually a lot of skill involved in loading ships, including having good balancing, so that ships don't capsize when they're in the ocean. And so although it's often called unskilled labor, there was a lot of skill involved in this trade traditionally. However, employers, companies, constantly seek one thing, to increase profit, right? And that means to reduce costs. Labor is a central cost in many industries, including traditionally, not anymore, in shipping. For a variety of reasons, new technologies are being investigated in the 40s and 50s, some of which supported by tax dollars in the U.S. Navy, right, is actually a very important, somewhat secret, not illegal, player in funding research in the 40s and 50s. lot of time this story is sort of reduced to some truck driver in New York named Malcolm McLaren who, like, has this idea out of the blue. And that's actually sort of a mythic and false creation story. He founded a company later called Sealand, which is one of the central container companies in the world. But a number of companies, including a company that sailed between San Francisco and Hawaii, Matson, which controlled the Hawaii trade, was also simultaneously developing these technologies that resulted in a standardization of shipping so that you could load off pier, really anywhere in the world, these standardized metal boxes, 20 or 40 foot long containers, is also a term used, right, so that they can be loaded and stacked using large cranes so that you could stack 2, 5, 10 boxes, if you will, up on top of each other. And then instead of loading into ships, you load on the tops of ships dozens, hundreds, thousands of these containers that then can be moved with this other technological advancements from ship to rail to truck, right, in a relatively seamless and impressive movement of goods, right? And as a result of that, a whole bunch happens. So first, it is much easier and faster and therefore cheaper to move goods. That benefits companies, wholesalers, retailers, not just shipping companies, but also manufacturers, as well as retailers, right? It allows for, potentially, as costs will plummet, because the number of workers will plummet, that you can, say, move your company from, I don't know, California to China, right? And then, because the costs have dropped a lot, you can manufacture in a lower-wage country and then ship it back to a higher-wage country where there are still consumers, right? This is not unique to the U.S. and China. This is a story of really manufacturing moving from the original industrialized countries to poor, lower-wage countries in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, right? There's also free trade agreements and other sort of components to the sort of the rise of this system, but the simple container is actually essential to this. Now, dock workers in the Bay Area are the busiest port, the most powerful union on the West Coast, you might say in America, right? The most left-wing union standing, say, in 1960, right? With the most well-known radical, supposedly, leader in the labor movement, Harry Bridges, right? But what Bridges does is that he and others in the late 50s negotiate with a association of shipping companies in the Pacific to transition from the traditional method of loading and unloading cargo to this containerization, which often was called automation or mechanization too. Although automation is a term that is coming back for whatever reason, but it was mechanization typically then. But the specific one is containerization, which is not a technology alone. It's really the process of how goods are moved. And because you can move more goods faster and simpler with cranes, you need fewer workers. Is the union going to go along with this? Well, it's, again, a complicated story, and I don't know if I've told it fully in my book, but I spent several chapters trying to unpack this, in which basically Bridges, this left-wing radical, convinces his membership, which is an ornery rank and file who believes in their power and also has many radicals, to support this transition. It was called the Mechanization and Modernization Agreement, M&M, and it allowed for a, as opposed to the union fighting it and trying to sort of through wildcat strikes or other means or just not agreeing. The East Coast Union actually refuses to negotiate for a few more years. So literally the first union in the world negotiates this is the San Francisco-based union here, right, in the Bay Area, where Local 10 is also, but the headquarters of the union is in San Francisco too. And as a result of this transition, well, Bridges said, well, we're going to, first of all, we deserve a share of the machine, right? We want some of the money, right? So productivity will go up. You're going to make more profit. We want some of that. You need to pay us much more. You need to provide us greater benefits. Now, you could call that a sellout, or you could call that actually, under capitalism, just a sort of a strategic and savvy way to negotiate if you're powerful enough. In almost any other workplace, including union ones, employers don't ask to introduce a new technology. They just do it. It might result in massive layoffs, but it doesn't. You don't get permission and you don't get a cut, right? They also ensured not a single worker would be fired, right? So they guarantee the jobs of the entire current generation. And they did what they called shrink from the top. So essentially some of that money also went to early retirements so that older workers, including many of the 34 generation, would be able to have comfortable retirements, which I want myself to. I don't blame them for wanting, after working for decades in a tough industry, to want to retire in comfort. But unlike most industries, again, when a new tech is introduced, it often results results in massive instant layoffs. Now, if we contrast to Durban, the other port I study, containerization hit later. The government didn't ask the workers because the black workforce, all black workforce, had no power. They didn't have the legal right to be in a union or strike. They had this new tech introduced, and within 3 years, the workforce was cut in half, right, without a dime being shared with the current or former workers, right? And so the contrast between a powerful union and a non-union port is dramatic when it comes to technological change.
Well, let's talk about Durban,
sure,
which is not just another port, another central port in another part of the world that you've decided to contrast against the San Francisco Bay Area. But as we'll talk, there are connections because, of course, ports by definition are connected to each other. And in the case of radicalism on the docks, internationalism and international solidarity also connects mm-hmm. these ports to each other. But as oppressive as the conditions under which the ILWU was formed in the 1930s following this general strike, they really pale in comparison to the circumstances that the Durban dock workers found themselves in, which of course is under apartheid, where unions were not legal. Tell us about the port at Durban, South Africa's most important port, and its history during this sort of comparable period through the 40s and the 50s into the 60s. And then later, you say, containerization came in the 80s. But what was that broader context in which their struggles took place?
Mm-hmm. Pale in comparison is an apt term, right? So in the Bay Area, right, the workforce originated, the union was 99% white, but it became over time increasingly diverse and increasingly African-American. In South Africa, which was colonized by the Dutch in the 1600s, but then taken over by the English in the 1800s, and then becomes independent, so-called, in the early 1900s. But independent meaning that the white minority was independent, whereas the 85% of non-white people literally were not citizens, and that the black majority of that, Native Africans of nine different ethnic groups, had no legal rights under the South African Constitution, and so that black workers didn't have any rights to unionize, strike, etc., right? Blacks in general, not just in the Durban waterfront, were brutally exploited, and as horrible as racial segregation was in the United States, as you said, it was far worse for the black majority in South Africa in many, many ways. Durban, on the east coast of South Africa, which is the Indian Ocean, at the southeast tip of the continent, is the biggest port in the country. It's the biggest port in Africa, busiest port in Africa from the 20th century onward to today. Because of racism that preceded but then worsened in the late 1940s with the rise of apartheid, all work was segregated. There was no such thing as a multiracial workforce. Whites had some jobs. Indians had other jobs. Coloreds, as the term was, mixed-race people, had other jobs. Blacks had other jobs, period, right? So the worst jobs, the least-paying jobs, the hardest jobs, generally were reserved for black people. In Durban, almost all those were Zulus, the ethnic group, which is the largest ethnic group in that region of the country, but also some Pandos who come from another area called the Eastern Cape or the Transkei. And so Pandos and Zulus, who were all black and shared much in common, but nevertheless, you had two ethnic groups who were seen as the same under the law, work the waterfront. And they work as casual, like in the pre-ILWU era. They're hired by the ship. But time and again, these workers informally organized. They did so on the job, as I was mentioning with Leo Robinson. They were forced to live generally in company-supplied housing near the port so that they could be ready at any time to work. But, of course, that means that not only are you talking to your fellow workers on ship, you're talking to them in the bathroom, right, in the bedroom. The conditions in these hostels, as they were called, were horrific, overcrowded, disgusting, no privacy. And then you socialize. The only thing that you could do in the city if you're a black person, almost the only thing, would be to go to the beer hall, right? And so then you're socializing with your fellow workers. So what do? You decide you can't strike, but you want to raise because you're desperately poor. You can all not report for work that day, right? It's legally not a strike because you don't have the right to strike, but it has the same effect, right? Because you've all decided to not show up for work. Suddenly the boss can't hire anybody. And time again, dock workers had self-organized informally in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, increasingly in the 1950s, which is also the rise of the American Civil Rights Movement, as we think of it. They're coordinating with organizations that are overtly anti-apartheid. So although a lot of their strikes are really for a raise, which you could say is divorced from politics, although I would disagree, right? The state and employers don't see these things as divorced. They use tremendous military and police powers time and again to break these strikes or force these workers back to work because or fire the entire workforce and replace them with rural blacks who were imported into the city. But time and again, these workers are able to demonstrate shocking power. Like I said, for raises, which sometimes worked, but also coordinating their stayaways, as they became known in the late 1950s, which is just another word for a strike, but not illegal, coordinating with workers in other places and other cities that were being organized by the African National Congress and the South African Congress of Trade Unions, which, and so in the late 50s, we're starting to reach a crescendo in the domestic anti-apartheid movement. At that time, very few non-South Africans know about what's going on in South Africa or really give it much thought, right? And so it's really a domestic struggle, although later it will become global.
I'm speaking with historian Peter Cole about his book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. The book looks at dock workers in those two places and their trajectories over time. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So unfortunately, of course, we're skipping over lots of history in these two places where these dock workers operate. Their struggles, in some sense, come together over the anti-apartheid movement, which really picked up momentum in the 1980s in Europe and in North America. And the ILWU, that is the dock worker union based in the San Francisco Bay Area, was a real pillar in the anti-apartheid movement. Tell us about the role that they played, not simply in sort of joining arms with other people who were criticizing the South African government, but actually taking a stand as workers in solidarity with the people of South Africa.
Well, it's my pleasure. This also became one of the central themes of my book and wasn't initially planned. But through research, I actually learned all sorts of things. Go figure. So, you know, actually, it goes back to the early 1960s, where the first action against a South African ship or cargo from South Africa that docked in San Francisco, where a community group or a series of groups, including civil rights groups, but also the most important solidarity group in the U.S. supporting African liberation called the American Committee on Africa, led in San Francisco by a white woman named Mary Louise Hooper, who had been expelled from South Africa because she was an ally of the anti-apartheid struggle there, throws up a picket, had coordinated in advance with leaders within the ILWU so that when this ship comes in with South African cargo, 1962, timed for Human Rights Day is in early December, where hundreds of dock workers, essentially who were dispatched, refused to cross this community picket line in order to protest apartheid in South Africa. Fascinating, a few months later in the union's newspaper called The Dispatcher comes a letter from the South African Congress of Trade Union thanking them for taking a stand. Now, when they do this, let us point out that they're actually not getting paid, right? Like, and so although you might attend a rally, and that's awesome, right? These workers are actually making economic sacrifices, which very few other people do when they maybe get involved in a protest. So this sort of action happened in 62. In the mid-70s, Local 10's rank and file, led by a guy named Leo Robinson, an African-American, and a white man named Larry Wright, who is a fascinating guy with a red diaper baby, who was in Local 10 and other white and black members of the union. The union votes in support to create the Southern Africa Liberation Support Committee, not just South Africa, but Rhodesia is still a white minority state that becomes Zimbabwe. Mozambique is emerging from Portuguese colonialism, right? And so they don't want to only support South Africa. They also want to support other liberation struggles in the region. Why? Well, two basic reasons, I say. One, really sort of many of these guys are African-American and identify as in sympathy and solidarity with other people who are black in their mother continent, right? Secondly, a lot of them, as you said earlier, are internationalists because of their left orientation. I'm mindful that some right-wing people are internationalists, too. During the Cold War, dock workers in New York City one time boycotted a Soviet ship, right, because of their opposition to communism in the Soviet Union. But almost all actions of this sort were generally driven by leftists, and not just in the U.S., but in Australia and Hamburg and other ports. So then in the 80s, as you said, when the movement after decades of actions, right? I mean, it can be easy to forget the decades of work. But by the early 80s, it's reached a lot of more people in the U.S. and North America, as you say, but also in Europe, other parts of the world. Actually, Africa was the first continent that supported the anti-apartheid movement. In the 60s, they pushed in the United Nations to basically isolate South Africa. But in San Francisco, as a Dutch ship comes into San Francisco non-containerized, which is unusual, but not unheard of, where a ship comes into San Francisco, not Oakland, which is where most of the work is, and they knew this in advance because they control the information. The union has clerks, not just dock workers, who work in the industry. Ship comes in. They dispatch people intentionally who are going to be supportive of the struggle as opposed to crossing a line, right? In other words, they dispatch people who are willing to sacrifice their own economic gain to help these people. And then they unload most of the ship. And there's a longer story to this, too. But they intentionally do not unload cargo from South Africa. They're trying to not basically break their contract because workers don't get to decide what work they do or not. The employer tells them what to do, right? And so, but they intentionally not unload the South African cargo. And then for 11 days, there's a standoff at this pier. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of community people rally in solidarity. It's not a picket line, but they're not crossing a picket. They themselves essentially stopped work. But out of that also came tremendous growth of the Bay Area anti-apartheid movement. Several months later, students at UC Berkeley start to become very active in one of the leading campuses for that. They very much are inspired by the dock workers, right? And there's some famous photographs of ILWU banners amidst a crowd of or a sea of student protesters and sympathizers in front of Sproul Hall, the classic administration building where the free speech movement had also protested and many others in the 60s and 70s. But on many campuses around the country, not just in California, there was a lot of student protests. Many people have not really thought about how labor unions and workers were also very much a part of it. Usually you think about students, sometimes black students, and then many churches who took a sort of a stand of conscience against apartheid. But I am saying that workers, in fact, were essential in the U.S. as well as in other countries, although in other countries there's a little more appreciation for the centrality of worker power. Whereas in America, it's another example of our blind spot in appreciating how dock workers, but more generally organized workers, because a lot of teachers were actually central to working with the union dock workers in 84, especially black teachers in Oakland who were pushing the dock workers going, we want you to do more. Of course, everyone wants the dock workers always to do more. So Ron Dellums then showed up. Of course, he's the son of a longshoreman and the nephew of C.L. Dellums. And he's speaking. He's arrested right around the same time for sitting in at the South African embassy in Washington, D.C. But he represents Berkeley and Oakland. He might be, as is Barbara Lee, perhaps maybe not anymore with AOC, right, the most left-wing member of the House of Representatives, but, the action's happening in San Francisco, and it sort of becomes this incredible moment where the Bay Area anti-apartheid movement explodes in the mid-'80s, and it's actually then shortly after that Ron Dellums is the sponsor of the amendment of the bill in Congress that passes a sanctions bill against South Africa. Reagan vetoes it, but in a shockingly unusual instance, a bipartisan group of Congress, men and women, override Reagan's veto, right, to enact sanctions, and that's 86, right? And so a lot is going on, not just on the waterfront. It's a fascinating time. Now, it's even more interesting in South Africa in that era, but what's happening really sort of in the Bay Area is a very important part of this global struggle against apartheid.
Unfortunately, we're entirely out of time. I want to thank you. There's so much more, but if you'd like to check out Peter Cole's book, Dock Worker Power, Race, and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area, you can find a link to his book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches history at Western Illinois University and is research associate at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. I want to thank Ramsey Canaan for help with producing this program. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.